Good morning. This is Bishop Phoebe Rofe of the Episcopal Diocese of West Tennessee, and welcome to Faithfully Memphis. We broadcast live every Thursday morning from WYXR 91.7 FM out of Crosstown Concourse in Memphis. And each Thursday, we have the opportunity to talk with a guest, or in the case of today's show, two guests, about their life and their ministry and the ways in which they see God working in the world. The first segment of the show is always the saint of the day, and January the 18th, we celebrated the feast of the confession of Saint Peter the Apostle. Saint Peter and Saint Paul really considered maybe the two, you know, in our Anglican communion, there is a first among equals, and Peter and Paul are maybe the duo of the two sort of head disciples of the church, as it were. There are times when we know about God, and then there's another step when we actually know God for ourselves. And the confession of Saint Peter is a moment in time in which he confessed that Jesus was the Christ, the Messiah. So he actually knew God for himself. And he and his brother Andrew were the first disciples called by Jesus. Many of the amazing stories in the New Testament have to do with Peter. Peter was the one who attempted to walk on water. I think a lot of people are familiar with that story. Peter was also the one when he was on the mountain with Jesus and two other disciples at the time of the Transfiguration, who wanted to build three booths or three temples and stay up there forever. But notwithstanding that, and his confession of Jesus as Messiah, Peter was also the one who denied Jesus three times before the crucifixion because of fear and concern for his own safety. But yet Peter's story didn't end there, because Peter was also the one, after Pentecost, the coming of the Holy Spirit following Jesus's resurrection, who risked his life to do God's work. And one of the things that I appreciate about Peter is that he was someone who continued to grapple with certain issues throughout the course of his life. You know, I know in my own life, there are things that I feel at certain point, okay, maybe I got a handle on this, and then it'll come back up in a different way. And so Peter really believed that the disciples' primary focus should be to the people of Israel, the Jewish community. It was Paul who was convicted that this good news should be shared with the Gentiles. And Peter really struggled with that. And he got to a point where, you know, initially he was opposed to baptizing the Gentiles. And then he's like, okay, I'm on board. But then later on, he continued to struggle with the role of Gentiles in the faith community in its earliest days. Peter is also seen as sort of the first pope, as it were, in a sense, the one who is most closely connected with Rome. And according to a legend, Peter fled from Rome during the persecution under Nero, and en route sort of encountered Christ, the risen Lord, and then turned around and went back and was crucified head downward. So we learn from Peter that struggling as a part of the faith journey, continuing to deal with your own issues and what it means to be in relationship with God as part of the faith journey, even denying God will not deny God's love for us. And yet, through a broken, stubborn person such as Peter, the Lord did a powerful work. And so if God can work through Peter, maybe God can work through you and I as well. So we give thanks for his life, his ministry, his witness, and the inspiration that it gives us to keep going in spite of our brokenness, our frailty, the many mistakes that we have made and we will make. We can rest secure that God loves us and God can still work through us. So this morning, we are thrilled to have two guests in the studio with us, both of whom are Episcopal priests. We have Alyssa Newton, who is the vicar of St. Columba's Episcopal Church in Kent, Washington, and also the canon for congregational development and leadership formation for the Diocese of Olympia, and Phil Brochard, who is the rector of All Souls Episcopal Parish in Berkeley, California. Both of them are involved with the College for Congregational Development, and we might get them to talk a little bit about what that work entails as well. So to both of you all, welcome to Faithfully Memphis.
Thank you so much, Bishop. It's great to be here.
So glad to be here. And the space is pretty amazing that this place is in. This is great.
It is. So for our listening audience who may not have been to Crosstown Concourse, it was sort of a Sears major distribution center that had been vacant for years. And the Reverend Dr. Scott Morris, who is a physician and a United Methodist pastor, had the vision for not only a place for working class folks to have quality health care, but also to have apartments for artists in the area, as well as retail and other sort of office space. So yeah, it's a beautiful facility. So we're here with the two of you all, primarily because of this brand new book that's come out, Vital Christian Community, 12 Characteristics of Healthy Congregations. And so I thought I would start by asking, what was the impetus for the book? And let me just remind our listening audience that we are in the midst of a 3-month series on the future of the church. What does the church in a post-COVID world look like? And so we're having all sorts of conversations with people who have really thought very deeply about this issue and been engaged in this issue. So what was the impetus for the book?
Well, I think to start with, we started thinking about writing this book before COVID, and we wanted there to be a resource for congregational leaders who needed tools to understand how to help their congregations become more healthy, more faithful, and more effective communities of faith. Because one of the things that we'd realized in our work, and Phil and I both do consulting work as well as teaching and training work in congregational development, was that our churches know who they are, and they're experts on their own life. But often what congregations lack are the tools to help them mine that knowledge for their own discernment so they can perceive where God's calling them to go. And so we wanted there to be a book they could read that would help introduce them to some of these basic tools, but that are that come from both the world of organization development, which is its own field of academic study and practice, as well as the world of congregational development. And then Phil actually was like, they need even more concrete tools. So the weird thing about the book is it started with the appendices.
Oh, right. Wow.
Started
okay.
From the back and worked forward. Yeah. I'm always looking for resources that can bring together practical tools and stories. I felt like that's the way that I learned best, is to hear someone's story or a community story. And so we know we had these tools from the College of Congregational Development. And so we had something that we felt like many people could benefit from, and we wanted to make sure that we could get the information out in a way that people could realize that there's other communities that were already practicing this, that were doing this. I often had in mind my mother-in-law, who is a lay leader in her very small rural congregation, a Congregationalist church in rural California, because I figured if something like this could help her congregation be vital, be more healthy, then it would probably be able to help a lot of congregations, no matter the setting they're in.
Mm-hmm. So you said you started thinking about this book even before COVID. And one of the things that we have explored a little bit in our conversations thus far is that COVID didn't actually create a lot of the issues that we see. It maybe exacerbated it, but there were trends happening before. So what sorts of things had you all been noticing in your work as consultants? And I imagine going to different parts of the country, different types of churches, what sorts of things had you been noticing that sort of caught your attention?
I think one of the things that I noticed across the board, both in, you know, in my work as a canon, I'm mm-hmm. involved with all the congregations in our diocese, was that some congregations had a natural vitality to them that had something to do with leadership and mm-hmm. The practice of, healthy ways of listening to each other, et cetera. And some did not. And what COVID did was absolutely widen the gap mm-hmm. between those two. So as we watched what was happening in the Diocese of Olympia, when COVID hit, it just became immediately clear which congregations were healthy and which were not, mm-hmm. Because their ability to flex under stress became immediately evident. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that had to do with relationships with money. It had to do with the ability to deal and talk about their histories mm-hmm. With each other. Some of it had to do with demographic changes happening around. So in the Seattle area, there's a lot of growth, but also a lot of people leaving the city to live in other places. Where in our rural congregations, sometimes there's towns that are dying, mm-hmm. right? So there's all kinds of outside forces that are working on our congregations. But I think COVID and then the fact that culture is moving past Christianity as a social connecting force, right? So in the Pacific Northwest where I live, I think this is true where you are as well, Phil, there are more people who choose no religion mm-hmm. as their main religion than choose any particular one. And it's been that way for a while. Mm-hmm. But other parts of our country, the East Coast, the South, are only starting to look at this as a near future reality right. for them, that we're gonna all be in a place pretty soon where our religion is not something that's assumed mm-hmm. around other people.
Yeah, and I think that you're right, that COVID exposed things that were already there. It was a great stress factor. And for the churches that I've been in conversation with, whatever was present already, mm-hmm. the challenges, the stresses, just were turned up to 11. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. then the question became not just like there's this existential crisis, but I think now we're starting to move to this time of, okay, so what do we do with what's happened to mm-hmm. us and with us? I think that, you know, many churches were able to respond at first, but as it kind of deepened mm-hmm. after that first year into that second year, it became this, you know, like, who are we? What do we do? And actually, I think that's a really interesting place to be, mm-hmm. which is why I think we're in probably the most interesting part of this challenge of the last few years right now, because we're in this space of, okay, this has happened, but it's forced us to really examine what we do. I mean, I feel like for us at All Souls, it was a time of great reckoning.
Mm-hmm.
There was racial reckoning that happened. A lot of people, we had 20% of our households from our congregation leave the Bay Area.
Wow, that's significant.
It was a huge challenge for us. It still is a huge challenge because a lot of these families, a lot of these households were doing this reckoning. Like, do I really want to live here? For us, it's incredibly unaffordable housing prices.
Right.
So a lot of our young families said, wait a minute, I don't have to do this. And I think we've been afforded, we didn't want this, but mm-hmm. we got this time to really look deeply at, why am I doing what I'm doing right now? Why mm-hmm. am I living my life this way? Mm-hmm. And I actually think that this is a moment for the church to be able to say, well, there's another way to live.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very, very hopeful time, I think. Mm-hmm. Because it's this moment where we had to change, right? But this is the moment where we get to realize that we're not going back.
Mm-hmm.
That there's no recreation of the past that's going to give us the thing we remember. which means that it's a moment where we actually get to listen deeply to God and imagine things that we could not have imagined about what church could be and where church could go.
Yeah. And I think I share your excitement about being a leader of the church, you know, lay or ordained in this moment in history. And yet I know that for a lot of people sitting in our pews, it's really scary. Mm-hmm. You know, they've just been overwhelmed over these past couple of years with just trying to keep things afloat. And church has been that constant that they really want to stay the same above everything else. So there's also, while there's a sense of excitement, I would imagine there's also some mourning and some grieving of what was and that's never coming back.
Yes, you know, we are a church of practitioners, mm-hmm. right? More than many of our sibling Christian traditions, mm-hmm. Episcopalians practice Christian faith by the things we do together. Mm-hmm. We worship together. We, you know, some congregations genuflect together and cross themselves together. And all that got taken away, mm-hmm. right? The practice, the ways in which we experience our faith with our bodies all changed. Of course, there's a huge amount of uncertainty and grief that goes with that. There is, I think, in any change, mm-hmm. but especially this one.
Yeah, yeah. So I was really taken by the fact that sort of these are characteristics of healthy congregations. And when we think about the church, there are lots of ways to approach it. I mean, you all could have said, here are the 10 things to absolutely not do, right? And yet you all took the approach of health. What motivated that?
Yeah, well, one of the things was I didn't want us to write another book about how things were terrible.
Yeah.
There's plenty of books out there that can talk about the decline of institutional right. religion and Christianity, right. and that's well documented.
Yep.
Lots of folks have written that.
Yep.
I was interested in a book that, well, one of our colleagues and friends talks about heliotropism, in that mm-hmm. plants grow towards the light.
Yes.
And so as leaders, one of the things we can do is cast light, mm. because one of the most powerful things we have as leaders in any organization, in a family, doesn't matter, is where you pay your attention is where that family or where that organization is going to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And so for us, we wanted to show the light on health, on how do you become more healthy. And health is not like a static thing that you arrive at. It's actually a practice that you have to engage in every day. You got to get your steps in. And so that's what we thought. Well, and these are only 12. There's probably 87 or 103 characteristics. We figured we'd start with 12. It's a nice number.
Yeah, it's biblical, right? Jesus called 12. There were 12 right. tribes. And so how did you hone down from the 87 or however many yeah. to the 12?
Well, I think we started with looking at our own toolkits. Uh-huh. So we're both deeply involved in the College for Congregational Development.
And would you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. The college began in 2009 in the Diocese of Olympia, mm-hmm. and it was founded by, she is now an archbishop in the Anglican Church of Canada, retired, but mm-hmm. Melissa Skelton. Mm-hmm. Melissa was my priest, but before she became a bishop, and she started this for the purpose of equipping congregations with tools, because there are so many programs out there that are like that say do this particular curriculum in your congregation and you'll get this result. And mm-hmm. congregations are unique. There no thing that works for one congregation is guaranteed to work for another. But if you give them tools, then they can figure out what they need to do for themselves. And so we began this in 2009, and it just took off because every, you know, and we made people come to it. Like we said, if you want a grant from the diocese, you're going to have to come to this. And so when it first began, there was a whole front row of grouchy people who were not excited about being forced to come to this training experience. And, you know, they were the loudest converts. Converts often are the loudest when they've made the switch, because that what we encounter over and over when people come and bring their teams is, why has no one told us this information? Mm. Why haven't we been given these skills to, you know, how to run a good meeting, how to understand the core purpose of a congregation, how to, you know, actually analyze what's going on with newcomers and improve their experience of your church. How to find out what's working and mm-hmm. amplify that. And so when we decided to write this book, a lot of what we wanted to do was help people. Initially, what I had in mind was graduates of the program get back into things and remember how to do the things that we taught them. And what came out of it was these 12 areas of focus. I think when we sat down to talk about it, we thought just like, what do we use the most?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what do I use the most in my congregation? Mm-hmm. What are the things that I go back to over and over again in my leadership practice?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I came to the College for Congregational Development in a different path. Mm-hmm. I'm serving All Souls in Berkeley, California. I'd been an Episcopal priest for several years. And I kept finding that while I was really well trained in what worship is and how to create a worship service, theology, history, those were things I felt like I had a good grasp on. I didn't know what it took to build and maintain Christian community.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was looking for those, and I was kind of, I felt like I was in over my head leading this congregation. And so I was looking for a place to learn that, a book, whatever. And I ran into another Episcopal priest from Western Washington. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, we actually have a whole training program.
Wow.
That's just what that's about. And it's not just you as the leader, the ordained leader of the community, mm-hmm. but you bring lay leaders from your community. So you all learn together. And so I brought a couple of teams from my congregation to go to this training program. And like Alyssa says, I became, you know, I was like Paul on the road. The scales fell from my eyes, and I became a very loud evangelist because it made such a difference. There were so many things that as an Episcopal practitioner and a priest, I realized, oh, that's why I've been doing this. That's the purpose behind this.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you start to see things in that way, it just becomes clearer.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt like I had a way then to approach a situation, like if there was conflict,
mm-hmm.
right? Why is this conflict taking place right now? What's my part in it? And how can it be productive,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, I have not found a human community that didn't have conflict.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
But
it would be unhealthy.
It would
actually
be unhealthy.
Right.
Like, there's probably something there.
Yeah. Right. Then you're not really in real relationship.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's only about the weather and the Memphis Grizzlies if there's no conflict, right?
Right.
Right.
And as a Warriors fan, no, I'll stop right there.
Okay. Come on now.
Let's make friends. Let's make friends.
No, but for conflict, is it just something that's producing heat or is it also producing light?
Yes.
And so there was lots of different characteristics like that we felt we could help people just kind of pull back the curtain a little bit,
mm-hmm.
and see why is this happening and how can this be used to change people's lives towards God.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Phil and I bring two different perspectives to this practice because he's a convert,
mm-hmm.
right? I was trained in congregational development before I became a priest.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the equivalent of a cradle Episcopalian in congregational development. I'm not a cradle Episcopalian in my life, but this was the air I breathed and how I learned how to lead congregations, mm-hmm. and what to do. And so in our conversations, it's been illuminating to see what I assume, mm-hmm. happens in a church, because that's how I was taught from the very beginning to do things, and what he brings from someone who found it in kind of the middle of his priestly,
mm-hmm.
life.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. And so when it came to the book, it was, we do these week-long trainings, and you do it over the course of 2 years. You do 2 week-longs. You do projects in between.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty intensive. And what we found is not every congregation can bring folks there.
It
takes, especially for lay folk, we got a lot of teachers to do it because they get time in the summertime, say, but if you have to take time off of work, it's, mm-hmm. really challenging. And so part of our drive in writing this book was to say, how can we get these tools literally into the hands of people who could use it tomorrow,
mm-hmm.
right? They don't have to wait to come to the college, and all those resources are there, and you go in depth, and there's all kinds of great stuff that happens there. But how do we get this information to the people who can use it right now? And as you say, right now is a really important time, mm-hmm. in this liminal space as we're starting to come out of pandemic, and we want to see, where is God at this moment?
Mm-hmm. So given that you all have been in conversation, I would imagine, with lots of different people, Are there any one or two of these characteristics that people have been surprised by? Or is it all sort of things that we already knew, but we just sort of needed to see it reinforced or presented in a different way?
I think one of the most surprising things for folks is how we talk about anxiety and how we talk about conflict.
Okay.
Which is, we talk about anxiety as a neutral force. I think a lot of times we think about it as a negative thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, let's try not to be anxious. There's a lot of leaders are told you must have a non-anxious presence, right? Which
family systems.
Bowen. We do cover a little bit of that. And what Friedman. I think people hear when they hear that is you must not be anxious, which is a counterproductive thing to tell someone, because, you know, when I tell you don't think about an elephant, what's the first thing?
An elephant.
Think about? Right. Exactly. Right. So anxiety is just energy, and it can be very useful. Right. So we'll talk about anxiety as a useful force, something that can be harnessed. And actually, sometimes you want to provoke it. I think that's one of the most surprising things is when we talk about this a theory from the world of organization development by two people, Gleicher and Dana Miller, where they talk about intentional raising of dissatisfaction in order to move toward a change. And that surprises people sometimes, especially priests who we want from the depths of our hearts for our people to be content and happy at all times. And so to be told sometimes you've got to raise their dissatisfaction with a particular moment, a particular way of being, so that they can move toward that new thing that they're being called to.
Yeah, I think so often, I think this is also American culture where we don't want people to be dissatisfied, you know, in any way. Or we don't want to feel that because then there's something wrong with us. And what that particular tool taught me as a leader was if I am preventing that dissatisfaction from being felt by more people than just me, right? Because I'm feeling that whatever that dissatisfaction about what's happening in my community life or the wider community life, if I'm holding on to that or if I'm not allowing it to be felt, I'm also robbing those people in that system of the necessary catalytic energy to change. Because people don't change. Humans don't change unless they have to. And so how do we help people come, but not just like, okay, I'm feeling dissatisfied, but also provide them for a path for how to change. Right? That's what Jesus did all the time.
Yep.
Was say, you know, you can't live that way, but what if you lived this way?
Yeah.
That's right. And that theory includes not only raising dissatisfaction, but providing a vision and concrete first steps toward that vision. And what it's done for me is helped me to have a better relationship with my own dissatisfaction. You know, instead of being self-critical around, oh, I'm so unhappy or I want to be happy, I think like, oh, hello, dissatisfaction. What are you telling me? What piece of information are you giving to me that I need to know? It could be from God, this feeling of unhappiness or discontent, and there could be a thing I'm supposed to do with it.
I know years and years ago, I've been in spiritual direction off and on for a long time, and I was feeling dissatisfied. This was way before the ordination process started. And I had always thought, well, if the Holy Spirit is involved, then I'm going to be calm and I'm going to be relaxed. And my spiritual director reminded me of the passage where God is sort of remolding and reshaping that clay and said, think about yourself as the clay being pushed and squeezed and tugged. And so God can very much be involved even when it does feel uncomfortable or off balance. But I think I had in my own mind an association of the Holy Spirit with always peace and calm, not thinking about the healthy dissatisfaction that the Spirit uses to move us to a different point.
Absolutely. One of the things I've been thinking about a lot is the relationship between comfort and Christian community.
Yes.
And I think this is something that the Black Church has a deeper understanding of, that church is not necessarily a place to be comfortable.
Right,
but it is a place to be uncomfortable together, right? To be provoked into action together, and I think that for a lot of a lot of the white mainline church is a place to be comfortable, be with other people who are like you, to be mm-hmm. comfortable. And there's this missed opportunity there for church to be a place where we learn how to be uncomfortable, mm-hmm. where we learn the skills we need to go out into the world and be around people who are not like us, to love people who don't believe the same things that we do, you know, to be in conflict in productive ways. Like, what if we learned that at church? Mm-hmm. And it requires a shift in mm-hmm. thinking. Mm-hmm. Although we've all been uncomfortable at church now.
Right. That's been the last 3 years.
Yep.
And so in some ways, I really do believe that we are primed, mm-hmm. Having experienced this, for what to do next. And the challenge is, I think, and I feel this too, where I just want to go back to 2019, you know,
yeah.
And go back to the way things were and the way my congregation was and the way life was. And it's just not going to happen.
Right.
And the what can happen with that is a feeling, though, of despair. Like, well, if I can't go back to that, then
yeah.
what do I have?
Right.
And so right now, I think, is a really good time for listening, mm-hmm. for the deep kind of listening. Like, mm-hmm. okay, God, then what is it?
Mm-hmm.
Where are you present now? Because I do think that the Holy Spirit is a disruptor
mm-hmm.
as well as a comforter.
Yes.
Both are true at the same time.
Yeah.
And so we've had a lot of that disruption. And so now what do we do?
Mm-hmm.
Where do we go?
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to look different, as Alyssa said earlier, depending on your community.
Right.
But every community, we believe, and that's one of our chapters, you know, like, how do you listen?
Mm-hmm.
What are the practices to really listen deeply so you can take action?
So we're really fortunate to have the two of you here in Memphis, and there's going to be a workshop this evening at Grace St. Luke's, one of our congregations, where we have invited members of our governing board, our vestries or mission councils, along with clergy and other folks interested and engaged in congregational development, to come together for a conversation about what this might look like. So can you just give us a brief snippet of what those who are coming tonight might be in store for?
Absolutely. We're going to be talking about we're going to present two models,
mm-hmm.
And teach folks how to use them to understand their congregations more deeply and to do actions in their congregations mm-hmm. that would move them toward health. And the first one is the one that Phil's talking about here. It's it's called the Benedictine Life Model, and mm-hmm. it has to do with positive change, God-led change and discernment mm-hmm. in your congregation. How to understand that, how to kind of, what I say is how to get on the board with
mm-hmm.
that, so that the change that you are experiencing is one that comes from deep listening. and listening, you know, a lot of times when we listen to each other, especially mm-hmm. I think in our country, we're actually just waiting for our turn to talk, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
But Benedict in Christian community, which, you know, it's a very old tradition of Christian community, talked about listening with an openness to being changed mm-hmm. by what you hear. So that's the first part of what we'll be talking about and working with. And then we're going to talk about what happens to our expectations when they're disrupted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was talking about earlier, we wanted to go back. A lot of us want to go back to the way things were. And that's a very understandable human response when you come to a place of real disruption. This model, though, would teach that there are a couple other ways to respond. One way is you just stop, you say, okay, forget it, I'm not going to do it, you know, I'm going to try something totally different. But there's yet another way where you go back and you look at, how can I renegotiate again with the people I'm in relationship with?
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to talk about what that process is like, because we've come to the most profound disruption that we have experienced in our lives.
Absolutely.
What I think is really part of the reason why I love the Christian tradition that I'm a part of in the Episcopal Church is because we have such a profound love of the story of the Christian people before we got here.
Mm-hmm.
And so earlier today you were talking about Peter and mm-hmm. Peter's story, and this story is of Benedict of Nursia, who lived in the 5th and 6th mm-hmm. century. Well, what would the 5th and 6th century have to teach us about anything? Well, turns out Benedict lived in a time when life was disintegrating, the Roman Empire was falling apart, mm-hmm. and he was trying to figure out, how do you live a faithful life?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we lived in a time of great disruption and things falling apart, and we're trying to figure out how do you live a faithful life. And so we actually have tools that have been handed down over generations for moments just like this.
Mm-hmm. No need to reinvent the wheel all the time.
Now, the wheel's going to look different.
Yeah, of course.
Because life looks different now.
Right.
But, yeah, all those things are there mm-hmm. for us to be able to pick up and go, oh, my gosh, that totally fits.
Yeah, I think one of the deepest convictions that I hold about church is that whatever happens in the future, people will congregate.
Mm-hmm.
People will come together in community in order to support each other in faithful Christian life. That's not going anywhere. Some of the dear structures that we love and depend on mm-hmm. And sometimes confuse with that act of congregation, of congregating, might go away. But Christian community is the heartbeat of the transformation of God in Christian life. Mm-hmm. It's not going anywhere. So that's exciting. What's it going to be? What's right. it going to look like? How's that wheel going to roll? You know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm really looking forward to our longer conversation this evening with hopefully a great group of folk to really reflect on what this information that you all have to share might mean in our context here in West mm-hmm. Tennessee. You know, we are south of the Mason-Dixon line. We are part of the Bible Belt. And so I think Province 4, which is sort of one of the provinces of our Episcopal Church, one of the regions, the ways in which we divide ourselves, probably has the highest average sort of going to church attendance, and yet we're seeing declines too. So you're right. The trends that both coasts have seen first are even coming to the south. So it's a huge cultural transformation for a region of the country that has been steeped in very regular church attendance, and we're moving away from that.
Yeah, and that's that. I bet feels scary.
It is for a lot of people.
And a lot of leaders.
Yeah. What are we going to do with these buildings? Mm-hmm. Because whether you've got 20 people in the church or 200, you still have to pay the electric bill. Mm-hmm. You still have to pay the insurance. The guy still got to mow the grass. And so we've got buildings designed for much larger groups of people who are not comfortable being in the same space at the same time anymore.
Yeah, it's one of those situations where I think you have to look for the opportunity.
Yes.
Right? And the first thing, and I say this a lot to folks about one of the things I love about my congregation being located where it is that in the Pacific Northwest as a leader, when I look out into my congregation on a Sunday morning, I know that every single one of them is fully aware they could be hiking, watching football, sleeping in, playing with their dog. They could be doing anything else with no social consequence.
Right.
Right. So every human in a seat in my church has chosen to be there,
mm-hmm.
which is a powerful thing, not to be underestimated.
Right.
Right. You're going to have to figure out what to do with these structures. But if you've got a faithful congregation of people who are choosing to be there, that engine can take you all kinds of places.
Yeah. Great.
Yeah, I do think that this will be a time where, you know, we have this teaching about the new and old wineskins. And
yes.
New wine and old wineskins. And
yes.
So I do wonder if the next turn in the future of the church, right, as mm-hmm. we're looking down the next couple decades, is we're going to have to figure out what do we do with these buildings.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Right? Because a lot of times, as you say, Alyssa, we conflated church with a physical place.
Yes.
And one of the beliefs that we carry out in this book is that the church is the people and how the people come together. And so sometimes people come together in that beautiful space, but the beautiful space is not the thing.
Right.
And so we're going to have to really wrestle with that. And in Berkeley, California, it's just like in Kent, Washington, there's nobody who's showing up to church at All Souls who doesn't really want to be there.
Right.
Because, in fact, we're starting to feel the, you know, right now, people listening on the radio cannot see that I'm dressed in a button-down shirt, right?
Yeah.
But most of the time when I'm a priest, I dress as you're dressed today, Bishop, which is in a black clergy shirt mm-hmm. and a white collar mm-hmm. because I want to be an icon to the neighborhood,
yep.
to the people around, like, you know, the church is here and I'm mm-hmm. ready. And I hear confessions, people ask me for blessings. You know, I'm walking around in, looking this way, and I have some parishioners who, you know, when will come, they want to take a walk or have lunch, they'll say, could you not wear that collar thing?
Yeah.
Because I'm not out at work.
Yeah.
And they don't mean as a gay or lesbian person.
As
they
a
mean
Christian.
Like, I'm not out as a Christian.
Wow.
And so that's the context we're in. And because cultural Christianity is starting to fade away in ways that I think actually are just fine.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some ways that are also painful. But what we need to do is figure out, okay, so then what does it really mean to be a Christian?
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean to practice this way with the group of people?
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, at least people know what your collar is when you wear it around.
Well, not always. Not always. They sometimes, I mean, it really does depend on the circumstance. But you're right. As a woman,
yeah.
It's a very different experience sometimes.
Yeah. I did a lot of my ministry in New Orleans, and I was frequently asked, are you a nun?
Yeah.
Right.
Because it just, they couldn't even conceive that a woman could be a priest.
They can't make a story.
They could not make that.
They look and they can't make a story out of what they
no,
see.
No, I'm not. But let me talk to you about my faith. Yeah.
Right.
Well, thanks to both of you all for your faithfulness and for your, I'm thinking about last Sunday's gospel where Jesus asks the disciples, the people who become disciples, you know, what are you looking for? What are you seeking? And then said, come and see.
Mm-hmm.
And you all grasped a vision. And you're inviting others to come and see, not only the people who are going to be in the room together tonight at Grace St. Luke's, but again, for those of you who are listening, the book is Vital Christian Community, 12 Characteristics of Healthy Congregations. If in your particular context, you're looking for some tools to help you navigate a way forward, published by Church Publishing Incorporated, we encourage you to get the book and to really not just read it, but what do we say? Read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest. So wonderful to be with both of you all this morning.
Thank you very much.
So thanks again for listening to this week's episode of Faithfully Memphis. Just a reminder that you can hear this broadcast not only on the WYXR website, but also anywhere you listen to podcasts, including Apple Music and Spotify. So we encourage you to like us, to follow us, and to give us comments and feedback about things that you would like to hear us cover. Next week, there'll be a conversation between Miranda Cully, who is an Episcopal priest and the chaplain at St. Mary's School in Memphis, with Tracy Burgess, who is the executive director of the Dorothy Day House, a wonderful ministry in Shelby County that provides housing for homeless families, to talk about the work of the Dorothy Day House and how God is moving in the midst of that community. So until next Thursday, friends, stay safe and stay positive.